to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the pioneers of forensic science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We'll talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We'll also discuss times where science, or the people wielding it, failed. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. In my daily life, I'm a medical laboratory scientist. My profession is grounded in the how and why of biological and chemical data. I'm someone who looks at a clinical result and tries to see the human story behind the numbers. That's kind of how I look at these cases. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen and how science has developed to catch and convict the offenders. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want us to find each other and learn together. Today we're discussing the science of pesticides, chemically known as organophosphates, and their place in the dark history of deliberate poisoning. In the toxicology lab, we often analyze poisons that act as biological kill switches, compounds that cut the power, silence the system, and quiet the room. So, let's break down the science. As we explored previously, a poison like cyanide is a cellular suffocator. It sneaks into the mitochondria, locks down the complex 4 of the electron transport chain, and slams the brakes on the biological motor dead in its tracks. The cellular machinery simply runs out of gas, bringing the organism to a quiet, definitive halt. Organophosphates operate on the exact opposite physical principle. They do not cut the power. They weld the accelerator pedal directly to the floorboards. The body doesn't ineffectively pump the brakes. It forgets they exist, throttling full speed down a steep hill. Instead of shutting down the system, organophosphates redline the human autonomic engine. They flood the biological pathways with unchecked chemical signals, sending infinite, unbuffered electrical commands cascading through the central and peripheral nervous systems. The victim's body is overwhelmed by its own internal circuitry, forced into a state of relentless, hyper-stimulated crisis until the entire biological machine violently shakes itself apart. It is the starkest contrast you can find on the bench, where cellular suffocators bring an absolute silent freeze. Organophosphates force an uncontrollable, catastrophic surge. To truly understand the scale of a catastrophic autonomic shutdown, you first have to trace the precise mechanics of how normal synaptic machinery operates at the microscopic level. Communication begins at the presynaptic axon terminal. Instead of picturing a nerve as a simple wire, picture the very end of a nerve fiber as a massive microscopic docking bay, the presynaptic terminal. Inside the staging bay, thousands of tiny membrane-bound spheres called vesicles are packed tightly along the launching floor, loaded with acetylcholine like fleet ships waiting for deployment. Under normal baseline conditions, these patrols leave in an orderly, controlled rhythm to keep basic smooth muscle tone and resting functions ticking over smoothly. But when an electrical potential travels down the nerve, it hits the terminal like a full-scale alarm. Voltage-gated channels swing open and calcium ions flood the bay. That sudden influx is the biological equivalent of sounding red alert. Every docked vesicle is ordered to launch at once. They rush to the outer wall, fuse directly into the terminal membrane, and empty their entire chemical payload straight out into the narrow, tiny nanometer gap of the synaptic cleft. Once launched into the cleft, those acetylcholine ships diffuse rapidly across the gap and lock directly into dedicated docking bays on the other side. The nicotinic or muscarinic receptors embedded in the postsynaptic cell membrane. The moment the molecule docks, the receptor shifts shape, opening up heavy ion floodgates. Sodium ions surge into the cell, depolarizing the membrane and firing off the command, telling a muscle binder bundle to contract or a gland to discharge its contents. But here's the critical flaw in the system. If those acetylcholine ships remain locked into those docks, the alarm never turns off. The postsynaptic cell stays trapped in a state of continuous, unbroken electrical stimulation. To understand how the system collapses, you first have to look at the signal. Acetylcholine is the body's primary neurotransmitter for the somatic and parasympathetic systems. It carries the explicit chemical instruction for skeletal nerves and muscles to contract, smooth muscles to constrict, glands to secrete, and the autonomic nervous system to fire. Left unchecked, that signal would cause total system overload. And that's where the biological brakes step in. Anchored right there within the synaptic cleft is an enzymatic salvage fleet engineered for high-speed demolition. Acetylcholinesterase. The moment the acetylcholine shuttle pops off a postsynaptic docking bay, it gets pulled directly into traffic control. Acetylcholinesterase is one of the most kinetically efficient enzymes known to science, operating at a rate that approaches the physical limit of diffusion. It snaps the neurotransmitter apart in microseconds, clearing the gap so the cell can reset for the next wave. Inside the station, a specialized amino acid called serine 203 acts like a high-speed dismantler, splitting the chemical shuttle in microseconds. The main hull, the choline, is immediately ejected back into the open lane where high-speed recovery beams scoop it up and drag it back to the presynaptic base to build fresh neurotransmitters. At the exact same time, a passing water molecule sweeps through the station to wash away the remaining acetate exhaust, instantly resetting the station for the next arrival. This entire setup processes thousands of chemical shuttles every single second, clearing the flight paths within milliseconds of arrival. That relentless traffic control is what forces the postsynaptic docking base to release, closes the ion gates, and resets the board. It is the exact speed that allows your muscles to relax between twitches, your airway to remain clear, and your entire neural network to clear the lanes for the very next signal. Organophosphates freeze that shuttle in place. Exposure can be natural, such as coming into contact with cyanobacteria blooms that produce natural organophosphates like guanotoxin, or environmental like trace agricultural runoff or minor occupational contact. In these minimal amounts, our plasma enzymes act as biological sponges, just soaking up trace levels long before acute symptoms ever kick in. But as we always say in toxicology, the dose makes the poison. When a toxic dose of an organophosphate enters the human system, it does not merely disrupt normal neurotransmission. It initiates a hyper-targeted molecular hijack at the most critical control point in the synapse. The fundamental danger of these compounds lies in their structural design. The active oxon metabolite of an organophosphate, characterized by its central phosphorus to oxygen double bond, acts as a deceptive structural mimic of acetylcholine. It slips directly past the enzymatic defenses and enters the active site pocket of acetylcholinesterase, steering directly toward the catalytic triad. Under normal physiological conditions, serine 203 residue attacks the ester carbon of acetylcholine, splitting it apart instantly so the enzyme can reset. But when the oxon metabolite enters the pocket, serine 203 performs its nucleophilic attack on the organophosphate's central phosphorus atom instead. And that single chemical reaction changes everything. Remember that accelerator pedal welded to the floorboards? Instead of yielding an easy hydrolyzable acetyl enzyme intermediate that can be cleared by a passing water molecule within microseconds, the organophosphate forms a highly stable covalent phosphorylized ester bond with the serine hydroxyl group. The water molecule arrives to perform its usual cleanup, but the biological machinery cannot break this newly forged bond. The organophosphate refuses to let go. Cars keep arriving at the packed parking lot, but no one is giving up their space, and the cars can't stop. The reaction comes to a complete standstill. The catalytic triad is physically blocked, the active site is completely obstructed, and the enzyme is rendered permanently incapacitated. The essential biological brakes that regulate every muscle contraction, gland secretion, and autonomic signal in the body have been completely irreversibly severed. Without functional acetylcholinesterase present to clear the synaptic cleft, the delicate chemical balance of the nervous system collapses instantly. Acetylcholine accumulates in overwhelming quantities, trapped inside the microscopic gap with nowhere to go. Unable to be recycled or destroyed, it continuously floods every sorry, cholinergic receptor in the body, triggering an endless, unbuffered electrical signal that fires without pause. Cars keep arriving, no one's leaving, and the traffic signals all say, go, go, go! This relentless wave of chemical stimulation hits the body along two distinct anatomical pathways. At the parasympathetic nerve endings, muscarinic receptors are pushed into wild hyperactivity. Smooth muscles contract violently while every gland in the body opens its floodgates to maximum capacity. Clinically, this manifests as a terrifying systemic deluge. Massive bronchial secretions flood into the respiratory tract, effectively drowning the lungs from the inside out. The pupils constrict into unreactive pinpoint dots. Profuse cold sweating breaks out across the skin, and the gastrointestinal tract undergoes severe, unmanageable cramping and emesis. Vomiting. Simultaneously, parasympathetic input to the heart forces the pulse into a dangerously slow, faltering rhythm. In toxicology and emergency medicine, this total autonomic flood is known as classic sludge or dumbbell syndrome. It's a total internal car crash. While the glands and smooth muscles are drowning in secretional overload, a parallel disaster unfolds across the somatic nervous system at the nicotinic receptors. Skeletal neuromuscular junctions are continuously bombarded with unbroken activation signals. Skeletal muscle bundles begin to ripple and twitch uncontrollably, firing in rapid, involuntary spasms. This frantic, uncoordinated electrical storm rapidly consumes the tissue's available ATP energy reserves. Once those cellular power stores are completely depleted, the muscles give out entirely, collapsing from wild hyperstimulation directly into total flaccid paralysis. This is the adrenaline response of a driver who just has to get through, get past this, get out of the way. The ultimate cause of death in severe organophosphate poisoning is dual pronged, catastrophic respiratory failure. The victim is trapped in a devastating biological vise. The central respiratory drive is suppressed while the lungs fill rapidly with thick, uncleared bronchial secretions. And at the exact same time, peripheral neuromuscular paralysis takes home, causing the diaphragm and the intercostal muscles to lose all mechanical ability to contract. Incapable of taking a breath or clearing their airways, the victim suffers total respiratory arrest, the ultimate, multi-car pileup. When analyzing suspected organophosphate poisonings on the bench, toxicologists are rarely looking for an instantly reactive, fully formed poison. Almost all agricultural organophosphates are engineered with a thionosulfur bond, a central phosphorus to sulfur double bond. This specific structural choice provides necessary shelf stability and allows the chemical to remain lipid soluble enough to penetrate plant cuticles or insect exoskeletons. However, that same chemical stability means the parent compound itself is functionally a pro-poison. Once ingested, inhaled, or absorbed, it requires bioactivation, specifically by the liver. Phase one metabolic pathways in the liver, specifically cytochrome P450 enzymes like CYP2B6, CYP3A4, and CYP2C19 perform a desulfuration reaction. They strip away that sulfur atom and substitute an oxygen atom in its place and transform the inert cyanochemical into a highly toxic active oxon metabolite characterized by a central phosphorus to oxygen double bond. Because of this mandatory biological step, forensic toxicologists rarely rely solely on screening for the raw parent compound. Instead, we look around the neighborhood for known associates. We actively track and quantify the active oxon metabolites in blood, liver, homogenates, and tissue samples. The presence of the oxon is the definitive chemical proof that the compound entered a living biological system, underwent metabolic processing, and achieved its lethal active form. It's the chemical evidence of means, motive, and opportunity written directly into the victim's biochemistry. The same metabolic requirement provides an invaluable chronological tool for the postmortem investigation. In acute, rapidly fatal exposures where death occurs within minutes, the liver simply doesn't have enough time to process the entire dose. Finding high ratios of the unmetabolized parent compound relative to the oxon metabolite in gastric contents, blood, or hepatic tissue gives the toxicologist a direct biological clock. Remember when we discussed morphine versus heroin? Finding both in this case tells us that the toxic load was massive, the absorption was rapid, and the post-ingestion survival window was extraordinarily narrow. Like in most poisonings, postmortem redistribution also introduces a critical layer of complexity when interpreting organophosphate concentrations at autopsy. Because these lipophilic parent compounds deposit readily into fatty tissues and visceral organs during life, they begin to passively diffuse down concentration gradients after cardiac arrest. As cellular membranes break down, parent compounds and their oxon metabolites leach out of tissue reservoirs such as the liver, lungs, and gastrointestinal tract and into central vascular channels, as we've seen. Consequently, cardiac blood samples drawn during autopsy will again often exhibit artificially elevated concentrations that do not accurately reflect the circulating blood levels at the exact moment of death. To establish a true toxicological profile and avoid misinterpreting postmortem leaching as a massive acute bolus, the sample must be drawn from peripheral blood, typically from the femoral vein. And those ratios compared directly against tissue distribution markers. At the heart of every organophosphate sits a single highly reactive phosphorus atom, forming a structural scaffold that dictates both its commercial utility and its lethal precision. When organophosphates break down inside the body, that central phosphorus core degrades into a set of standardized, highly persistent urinary markers called dialkyl phosphates, or DAPs. instead of running for hundreds of individually commercial brands on chromatography, mass spectrometry, toxicologists screen urine for two main structural families: dimethyl markers from compounds like malathion, and diethyl markers from the heavier hitters like parathion or chlorpyrifos. Running a urinary DAP screen gives us an immediate tactical advantage on the bench. Finding these elevated metabolites instantly confirms the organophosphate exposure as a broad chemical class long before we've isolated the specific parent compound from tissue extracts. DAPs tell us what went into the body, but our final functional signature tells us what it did once it arrived. An irreversible aging. Once the active oxon bonds to serine 203, the complex enters a critical time-dependent transition known as aging. One of those organic side chains spontaneously breaks off, leaving behind a negatively charged oxygen atom that hyperstabilizes the bond. And this is the absolute point of no return. Once an enzyme complex has aged, therapeutic oxymes like prolidoxime can no longer strip the poison away. The active site is permanently sealed, and the body has no choice but to synthesize entirely new acetylcholinesterase from scratch over weeks. Measuring the ratio of bound versus aged enzyme in red blood cells provides definitive proof of true organophosphate toxicity, instantly separating it on the bench from reversible agents like carbamates. Because every compound in this class shares this fundamental architecture, they all converge on the exact same catastrophic outcome: the total lockout of the body's biological brakes, leading to an uncontrollable flood of acetylcholine and systemic autonomic failure. For a forensic investigation, this structural framework is a double-edged sword. On one hand, the shared phosphorus center makes every organophosphate leaves behind identical, predictable wreckage: aged acetylcholinesterase in red blood cells and standardized dialkyl phosphate metabolites in the urine. But for a perpetrator attempting to execute a crime, the specific variations built onto that core structure, the exact identity of the leaving group, and the side chains completely change how the poison behaves in the real world. Okay, so now that we've mapped out that the central phosphorus hub looks like, you know, let's look at how subtle shifts around those four spokes transform its function. We start with parathion. It's the classic phosphorothiate, where the leaving group is a p-nitrophenol ring. Its raw toxicity and rapid hepatic bioactivation make it the quintessential high-potency widowmaker of mid-century agricultural crime. The nitrophenol group makes the molecule exceptionally reactive once cytochrome P450 enzymes convert that sulfur to oxygen, leading to an almost immediate biological shutdown upon systemic absorption. And then chlorpyrifos, swapping in chlorinated pyridinyl ring, it significantly increases the compound's overall lipophilicity. This structural shift allows the molecule to bypass early metabolic elimination and hide deep within adipose tissue. Once stored in body fat, it slowly leaches back into the bloodstream over days or weeks, causing a delayed secondary cholinergic crashes long after the initial exposure events seem to resolve. With disulfiton, adding sulfur to the side chains creates a phosphorodiethylate formation that is bound directly to granular clay matrices for agricultural soil treatment. This structural addition introduces a distinct foul skunk-like odor and causes severe direct gastrointestinal destruction upon ingestion, compounding the systemic autonomic crisis with severe tissue necrosis along the digestive tract. Nasty. And then finally, in malathion, the addition of carboxyl esterase susceptible ester side chains was engineered specifically to make the compound safe for mammals. Human liver enzymes rapidly cleave those ester bonds into harmless carboxylic, acids, inactivating the molecule long before it can harm the central nervous system. Yet, under specific environmental conditions, such as high heat during storage, thermal degradation just alters those side chains to form isomalathion, which bypasses and destroys the liver's natural defenses entirely. So, while each formulation carries its own unique commercial disguise, physical state, and metabolic path, they're all built around the same lethal phosphorus nucleus, a central hub designed to lock down human neurochemistry and leave an unerasable chemical fingerprint in the postmortem tissue. The first chemical we mentioned, parathion, is a phosphorothioate ester featuring a central phosphorus atom double bonded to a sulfur atom. It's flanked by two ethoxy groups and a nitrophenol ring, which serves as its leaving group. Because parathion is a thionyl compound, those hepatic T450s strip its sulfur to yield paraoxon. This active oxon metabolite processes an extraordinarily high bonding affinity for the serine 203 residue of acetylcholine esterase, locking down the active site instantly. And it was first introduced in the late 1940s under commercial trade names like E605 and phthalate. Parathion became a staple broad-spectrum agricultural insecticide used heavily on cotton crops and fruit orchards. Because of its extreme, indiscriminate, non-target mammalian toxicity and low margin for human error, it earned the dark moniker of the Widowmaker in rural communities and was systematically banned or heavily restricted worldwide by the early 2000s. Ingestion, inhalation, or dermal absorption of parathion triggers a classic violent acute cholinergic crisis. The rapid accumulation of acetylcholine drives the parasympathetic nervous system into hyperdrive, resulting in profound bronchorrhea, intense bronchoconstriction, and systemic paralysis. Left untreated, central and peripheral respiratory failure shuts down oxygen intake within hours. In postmortem toxicology screening, analysts isolate urinary nitrophenol, a distinct metabolic product cleaved directly from the nitrophenol ring, alongside the classic diethyl phosphate markers, diethyl phosphate and diethyl thiophosphate. In the isolated, mountainous region of Mani in southern Greece, Christos Sigeronis, please forgive me on the names, realized that agricultural parathion could do far more than clear our olive groves. It could settle generational family feuds. Lacing communal water wells and shared olive oil stores, Sigeronis introduced a lethal dose of parathion directly into the daily lives of his neighbors. Within hours, healthy villagers began collapsing in violent, agonizing distress. And because it was the mid-20th century, local physicians fell straight into a classic diagnostic trap, seeing sudden cardiac arrest, severe respiratory distress, and rapid death. They chalked the fatalities up to acute, unexplained heart failure. Parathion's rapid bioactivation into its oxon form left behind a clinical storm that rural medicine simply wasn't equipped to decode. And without routine gas chromatography and postmortem work at the time, there was no automatic screen to flag dialkyl phosphates in urine or aged acetylcholinesterase in red blood cells. Sigeronis proved just how easily a high potency organophosphate could slip right past traditional autopsy protocols, hiding in plain sight behind a clinical misdiagnosis until the bench work finally caught up with the crime. Our next compound, chlorpyrifos, I know I've been struggling to say that all day. Chlorpyrifos is a phosphorothioate organophosphate built around a chlorinated heterocyclic ring, specifically 3,5,6 trichloro-2 pyridinyl group. Like other phosphorothioates, it acts as a pro-poison in its raw state, requiring bioactivation to convert the central phosphorus-sulfur double bond into the active lethal chlorpyrifos oxon. The heavy halogenation of its pyridyl group grants the molecule exceptional lipophilicity, allowing it to penetrate biological membranes effortlessly, cross the blood-brain barrier, and readily deposit into systemic fat stores. For decades, chlorpyrifos is one of the most widely used insecticides in the world. It was marketed under trade names such as Jersban for residential pest control and Lorsban for agricultural use. It was applied extensively across industrial cornfields, golf courses, and directly along indoor foundation baseboards for structural termite treatments before mounting evidence of neurodevelopmental toxicity led to broad residential bans. While acute exposure produces the classic autonomic meltdown, chlorpyrifos is characterized by a dangerous delayed clearance profile. Because of its extreme lipophilicity, significant quantities of the parent compound sequester deep within adipose tissue during initial exposure. Days after the patient or victim appears to stabilize clinically, the toxin slowly leaches back out of the body fat reserves into central circulation, triggering secondary cholinergic crashes. Furthermore, high-dose exposure carries a risk of organophosphate-induced delayed neuropathy, driven by the off-target inhibition and aging of neurotoxic esterase in peripheral nerve axons. The definitive analytical marker for chlorpyrifos exposure is 3,5-6-trichloro-2-pyridinol, commonly abbreviated as TCPY. Toxicologists quantify TCPY in urine, serum, and gastric contents using gas chromatography, mass spectrometry, to confirm both the exposure class and the specific parent compound. In 2004, the sudden illness of 31-year-old radio engineer Jim Tone Kuhn. I hate people trying to pronounce people's names. I always think I'm gonna like just completely butcher it and offend someone, but I'm trying here. Jim Kuhn, I don't know, in Mooresville, North Carolina, baffled attending physicians because no one in the emergency room knew that his wife, Lori, was executing a calculated domestic murder using concentrated agricultural lorazepam, a heavy-duty insecticide. To bypass Jim's senses, Lori stirred the pesticide directly into pitchers of sweet iced tea and Kool-Aid, and the heavy sugar and intense fruit flavoring did double duty. They masked the harsh chemical taste while completely muffling the sharp petroleum solvent odor of the commercial formula. As Jim suffered repeated violent episodes of gastroenteritis, severe respiratory distress, and neurological decline, hospital staff fell straight into a clinical trap. With no obvious signs of physical trauma, doctors treated him for an aggressive, unexplained systemic infection. And Jim died after weeks of progressive collapse. The true story didn't emerge until the autopsy, when forensic toxicologists got his samples onto the bench. Using gas chromatography mass spectrometry, analysts screened his tissues and gastric contents, isolating massive concentrations of the raw chemical along its side, its, you know, primary metabolite, the TCPY. Finding that chemical combination gave investigators an unassailable biological thought. It proved repeated, deliberate acute poisonings, completely dismantling Lori's claims that Jim had suffered a sudden natural illness and securing her conviction for first-degree murder. The next chemical, disulfatan, belongs to the phosphorodithioate subclass of organophosphates. It's characterized by two distinct sulfur atoms bonded directly to the central phosphorus atom. And one forms a double bond, while the second one forms a single thioether linkage that connects to an ethyl-thioethyl side chain. Because of this unique sulfur-heavy architecture, disulfatan requires a complex multi-step biological activation sequence in the body. Hepatic enzymes must first oxidize the thioester sulfur into sulfoxides and sulfones, not the kind you talk to, followed by cytochrome P450 mediated desulfuration of the central phosphorus sulfur double bond to ultimately yield hypertoxic oxunsulfone metabolites. Engineered primarily as a systemic agricultural insecticide, disulfatan was widely distributed under trade names such as Dicystin. It was manufactured as a granular soil application for crops like potatoes and cotton and ornamental plants. And when applied to the field soil, plant root systems absorb the chemical and translocate the pesticide up through their vascular tissues to kill chewing and sucking insects from the inside out. Systemic exposure triggers a rapid, severe cholinergic crisis. However, because commercial formulations were bound to heavy granular matrices and organic solvents, ingestion often inflicted immediate harsh chemical irritation directly into the gastrointestinal mucosa. The abundance of sulfur groups within its molecular structure imports a pungent, foul, skunk-like or heavy garlic odor to gastric contents, breath, and body fluids during autopsy. In forensic autopsies involving oral ingestion, analysts frequently find intact, insoluble, granular carrier residue adhering directly to the gastric mucosa. Confirmation relies on isolating disulfatan oxon sulfone metabolites alongside the parent compound using gas chromatography paired with nitrogen phosphorus detection or liquid chromatography mass spectrometry. Just a few years ago, in June 2022, in a quiet village of Mysore, India, local authorities entered two homes belonging to the Vanmore family and found a nightmare. Nine people, three generations, all dead in an apparent mass suicide pact. And on the surface, the scene looked closed. Notes left behind pointed to crippling debt, and initial assumptions pointed to a family driven to the edge. But at the autopsy table, toxicologists uncovered the real weapon. Heavy, acute organophosphate pesticide laced into the cups of evening tea. Now, I suppose they could have been like Jim Jones in it, but it didn't seem likely. And so what the local police first read as a desperate suicide pact was actually a calculated mass homicide. Abbas Bhagwan, the local occult practitioner, had swindled the family out of millions under the promise of locating hidden treasure. And when the Vanmore brothers demanded their money back, Bhagwan executed a methodical plan, calling family members down one by one and handing them poison tea, and then forcing the brothers to write notes implicating local money lenders before the poison shut down their central nervous systems. It was the bench work confirming identical, overwhelming organophosphate concentrations in all nine gastric matrices, while investigators noted the total lack of typical suicide indicators that stripped away the staging and exposed a ruthless mass murder. And then, lastly, Malathion, which is a wicked name, by the way, is a phosphodithiate organophosphate distinguished by its two ethoxycarbonyl ester side chains and two methoxy groups attached to a central phosphorus atom. Like its structural relatives, its primary bioactivation pathway converts the central sulfur to phosphorus bond into naloxone, a potent acetylcholinesterase inhibitor. Malathion is a ubiquitous, low-cost commercial insecticide used globally for municipal mosquito fogging. You know, those little trucks that drive around town spraying stupid gas. Those things. Residential garden control and agricultural pest management. Because of its purported safety profile in mammals, it was historically formulated as a prescription topical treatment for human head lice. You know, the little bottles. Anyway. And under normal physiological conditions, malathion actually possesses an extraordinarily high therapeutic index in humans. Mammalian liver tissues produce abundant carboxylesterase enzymes, which rapidly perform nucleophilic hydrolysis on malathion's ester side chains, converting the molecule into harmless water-soluble dicarboxylic acids long before dangerous quantities can undergo hepatic bioactivation into naloxone. However, if these liver carboxyesterases are inhibited, saturated, or structurally bypassed, the molecule's benign profile vanishes, causing severe, sudden cholinergic toxicity. Forensic screening isolates dimethyl phosphate, dimethyl thiophosphate, and dimethyl dithiophosphate in urine alongside gas chromatography analysis to quantify the ratio of malathion to its toxic thermal isomer, isomalathion. Unlike parathion or chlorpyrifos, malathion is a complete ghost in the homicide archives. Its high mammalian safety margin means perpetrators rarely reach for it, leaving its forensic footprint limited almost entirely to accidental farm poisonings, self-harm, and entomotoxicology screens on blowfly larvae. While I didn't find a true crime case using this specific formulation of organophosphate, I do have a true story of personally witnessing attempted murder by lice shampoo. Picture it. Wichita Falls, Texas, spring 1982. I was 6 years old, sitting at the kitchen table, minding my own business, because even then I was, like, highly independent. And my three-year-old baby brother got a wild hair, climbed onto the counter, and decided he was going to make mommy some coffee. Wires crossed in his little toddler brain? Maybe. Malice aforethought? Who can say? He then proceeded to attempt to make coffee for my sleeping mother by pouring an entire bottle of lice shampoo directly into the coffee pot. Now, my mom was absent-minded and neglectful, hence the two young children hanging out in the kitchen alone midday, and she was most likely on the spectrum, which means we can be slightly absent-minded, routine-based creatures. But he didn't even hide the evidence. He left that bottle right next to the pot full of sudsy, sludgy coffee. Silly boy. So, luckily for his burgeoning criminal career, or unluckily, whatever, there were no fatal consequences. But it was so close. Setting aside the obvious evidence handling issues of a 3-year-old leaving the murder weapon on the counter, and the fact that no one actually drank the sudsy sludge, here's the beauty of human biochemistry. Even if she had drunk it, she probably would have been completely fine. Over-the-counter lye shampoo formulated with 0.5% malathion relies entirely on the fact that human livers are absolute workhorses when it comes to carboxyl esterases. Had she ingested that concoction, her liver enzymes would have instantly attacked those ester side chains, hydrolyzing them into water-soluble dicarboxylic acids and flushing them through her kidneys long before the compound could ever bioactivate into malaxin and, trigger an autonomic meltdown. The attempted murder was dead on arrival, not just because of terrible criminal tradecraft, but because of basic human biochemistry. But that domestic safety net can create a dangerous illusion of invincibility. When the chemistry of malathion is altered, a compound that your liver normally laughs off can instantly transform into a mass casualty event. During a World Health Organization-sponsored malaria control initiative in Pakistan, over 2,800 field workers suffered acute organophosphate poisoning, resulting in 5 deaths after applying imported malathion formulations. The sudden mass toxic crisis baffled initial field supervisors because malathion was considered the gold standard for mammalian safety and vector control. But subsequent forensic toxicological analysis revealed that the pesticide batches transported and stored under extreme tropical heat had undergone thermal isomerization. High ambient temperatures caused a structural rearrangement within the formulation, swapping a methyl group to form isomalathion. And when the field workers absorbed this altered formulation, the presence of trace isomalathion selectively bound to and permanently inhibited their liver carboxyl esterase enzymes. And with the liver's primary defensive shield completely destroyed, the body can no longer detoxify the remaining malathion. The compound flooded directly into hepatic cytochrome P450 pathways and converted en masse into deadly malaxin and triggered systemic cholinergic collapse across thousands of workers. When you pull back from the individual case studies and look at these four bench compounds side by side, a clear pattern emerges in how chemistry gets weaponized in the real world. Each compound takes that same lethal phosphorus nucleus and dresses it up in a different commercial suit, creating four distinct forensic profiles that the lab has to untangle. First, you have parathion, the classic phosphorothioate. Once hepatic desulfurization converts to its active oxon, peroxon, it strikes with terrifying speed. In the lab, we trace it back through urine nitrophenol levels alongside DEP and DETP markers. It remains the quintessential historical widowmaker, the raw, high-potency rural weapon of choice before modern agricultural controls took over. Next, chlorpyrifos, a chlorinated phosphorothioate that transforms into the chlorpyrifos oxide. Its defining characteristic is its heavy halogenation, which grants it extreme lipophilicity. This allows it to hide deep within body fat, creating a slow drip release that leads to prolonged or secondary cholinergic crashes long after the victim seems to stabilize. Toxicologists pinpoint its presence by isolating the TCPY metabolite in gastric contents and urine, exposing cases where concentrated agricultural formulas were hidden in food or drink. Then there's the disulfiton, with the phosphorothioate whose metallic pathway generates toxic disulfiton oxone sulfones. Manufactured as a granular matrix for systemic soil absorption, it introduces direct physical evidence in an autopsy, those dark, insoluble, granular gastric residue adhering directly to the mucosal folds in the stomach lining, often accompanied by the distinct skunk-like sulfur odor that perpetrators attempt to mask in heavy domestic meals. Finally, we have malathion, a dicarboxylic phosphorodiethylate that converts to naloxone. Engineered specifically with ester side chains to be rapidly neutrophized by mammalian liver enzymes, it was supposed to be the safe organophosphate. But when forensic toxicologists measure high DMP levels alongside an elevated isomalathion ratio, it tells the story of thermal degradation and broken biological shields, proving how improper storage or environmental heat can turn a routine household spray into a sudden fatal trap. Different trade names, different physical forms, and different routes of administration, but every single one of them leaves an undeniable chemical record locked inside the victim's tissue. And whether it's manufactured as a high-potency agricultural spray, a granular soil treatment, or a routine urban insecticide, organophosphates share an undeniable biochemical trajectory. No matter the commercial brand name, the color of the liquid, or the method of administration, they all target the exact same catalytic triad, permanently incapacitate the exact same acetylcholinesterase enzyme, and force the human body into an agonizing autonomic shutdown. A perpetrator can try to disguise organophosphate poisoning as an unexpected acute cardiac event, a sudden gastrointestinal virus, or an unexplained natural respiratory failure. In the field, without specialized blood draw or high index suspicion, those illusions sometimes work for a moment. But once the tissue samples and fluid tubes reach the laboratory bench, the chemistry doesn't lie. The presence of standardized urinary dialkyl phosphates, the irresistible signatures of aged acetylcholinesterase and red blood cells, and the isolation of specific oxime metabolites strip away the mask every single time. Modern mass spectrometry leaves no room for criminal tradecraft to hide. Next week, we're leaving the agricultural supply stores behind, and God, this very difficult vocabulary, and stepping directly into the highway motels and pine flats of Central Florida as we examine the forensic toxicology, behavioral psychology, and controversial physical evidence surrounding Eileen Wuornos. So, if you haven't already, please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue analyzing these cases along with me, or just laughing at me trying to not butcher scientific terms. And if you found today's deep dive into the chemical kinetics, forensic signatures, and lethal mechanics of organophosphate pesticides Fascinating. Please take a moment to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred platform. Reviews are the lifeblood of an independent show. They help other science-minded true crime fans find our community, and I highly encourage you to tell your accomplices, I mean friends, to come along and learn with us. I always want to hear your analytical breakdowns of any of these cases or any future topics you want to see dissected on the bench. If you have a favorite poisoning, tell me about it. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon at Science of Murder, or reach out directly via email at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. Stay curious, stay scientific, and I'll see you in the next episode.